Welcome to Discovering and Sharing Shuswap History.
The Shuswap region, like other regions of the province, is named after the Aboriginal people who lived here for many thousands of years prior to when the white man appeared. It is likely that the fur traders, who were the first to arrive here in 1811, could not pronounce the word Sequetmik, or Shuapamu, as recorded by famed surveyor George Dawson, or Suxwapimu, as recorded by ethnographer James Tate, which was the word the Aboriginal people used to describe themselves. It is also possible that the early traders first learned the Sequetmik language from Western bands who pronounced Sequetmik with a shoe sound. Other meanings of the word Sequetmik or Shuswap include upper waters, spillover of water, and downriver. Consequently, their original mispronunciation, Shuswap, became the word used to describe this region's indigenous people, as well as many of the region's geographic features. It is likely David Thompson who began the usage, as his 1813 map gives a rough sketch of a large lake draining into Shuswap River to the west. The word Sequetmik has been fully revived and is now used as the name for the Shuswap Nation's Cultural Education Society. It is also significant that the entire Shuswap Nation, that includes 17 bands and many watersheds, has the same name as the Shuswap Watershed. The Shuswap people are classified as part of the Interior Salish Ethnic Division, based on their language, which is one of 34 dialects in the province. Shuswap territory once stretched from west of the Fraser River to the Rockies and from the Okanagan to north of Williams Lake. The 30 original bands, who numbered upwards of 7,000 or more, suffered greatly from the fur trade and later the gold rush, which brought starvation and diseases to a once culturally rich, self-sufficient people. As a result, their population shrank and nearly half of the bands were lost. When the Indian reserves were first allocated under Governor Douglas in 1862, the Shuswap's claim included a huge area from Scotch Creek to the North Thompson River. A few years later, the reserves were radically reduced in size by Surveyor General Joseph Trutch, but were then doubled when BC joined Confederation in 1871. Because of the unjust land allocation and the lack of treaties, an uprising nearly occurred in 1877, but Federal Commissioner Gilbert Sprout was able to cool down the situation. Although the Shuswap people left no written records, they had a rich oral history consisting of legends and traditions, some of which still exist today. Since the Hudson's Bay Company's records only contained a few references to the Shuswap peoples, most of the written information that exists today comes from the ethnography studies published by Frank Boa in 1890 and George Dawson in 1881 and James Tate in 1909. Further knowledge can only come now from the archaeological digs and carbon dating. Unfortunately, many artifacts disappeared long ago into private hands and distant museums, and many heritage sites adjacent to the lakes and rivers have been destroyed by land development and erosion. The hardships endured by the Shuswap people by the loss of their ancestral lands were compounded by the government's deliberate attempt to destroy their culture. In 1890, a residential school was built in Kamloops, and all native children were required to attend. The children were forbidden to speak their language and were forced to adopt the white culture. For many, alcoholism and despair took over their lives. Thankfully, in the last few decades, the tide has turned, as the Shuswap language is now taught in Shuswap Nation schools, and the 17 Shuswap bands are becoming economically, socially, and culturally successful. You can learn more about the Shuswap people by visiting their website, www.sequetmik.org, and that is spelled SECWEPEMC.
It was an age of innocence, those years just before the First Great War, a time of confidence and growth, and most of all, of optimism. Optimism framed those virtues instilled in the colonies during Queen Victoria's reign: duty, honor, faith in church and empire, and hard work. There was a shape and a stability to life in Salmon Arm, British Columbia, through a period that saw it grow from about 250 people at the turn of the century to well over 1,000 in 1914 when its young men went off to war. This town in the interior of British Columbia is, as all towns, determined by its geography and the imagination of the men and women who were its pioneers. Salmon Arm is situated at the north end of the Okanagan Valley on the shores of Shuswap Lake, a large body of water which is part of the Thompson River system. The Canadian Pacific Railway, completed here in 1885, made immigration and land settling in the area inevitable. The first settlers found the area, known for centuries by the Shuswap Indians of the interior, Salish people, to be rich in the resources they required: land, timber, fish, a climate to be envied by anyone, and transportation, the train and paddle wheel boats, already in place. Clearing the land was the first task they set themselves by methods which would be unthinkable today. Acres of good timber were set on fire just to get a small farm started. As land was cleared, industries began. Rail ties for the new railroad, lumber for the building going on all over Western Canada, and the founding of farms and orchards. It was believed that non-irrigated fruit coming from the northernmost areas where they could be successfully grown were the sweetest and most tasty. Salmon Arm soon made a name for itself worldwide, shipping more than 100 or more varieties of apples as well as plums, pears, grapes, strawberries, and cherries. Success in all these endeavors was optimistically almost expected, and from this confidence came growth and progress beyond even these pioneers' dreams. As you read through their words, you will see little confusion about what they believed in and who they trusted. Improving living became important as the world careened towards war. Fixing the impossible, unimproved streets, electing to pay for electricity and sewerage for the new city, and gradually acquiring telephones and the ridiculous new automobiles were part of the astounding world of the time. People knew each other in the turn-of-the-century Salmon Arm and its environs. Even though the community and its rural areas had ethnic pockets, like the Finnish community of Tappan and White Lake, Little England at South Canoe and its elegant homes, and remittance men and Little Scotland at the foot of Mount Ida, the people shared the town's entertainments and enthusiasm and pride in its growth. Nearly everyone went to some church, and the number of churches grew almost as fast as the stores, which were popping up everywhere. As we read through the newspapers of the day, an emerging sense of belonging here is evident, as is the feeling of being Canadian, lusty, ambitious, confident. We know what these people didn't know, that there is a war and a depression in their future, so the shining optimism, as shown in the writings and photographs, is all the more poignant. Extensive use was made of material from the Observer, later called the Salmon Arm Observer. The newspaper started here in 1907. Other important source material was obtained at the Salmon Arm Museum, where many oral histories have been cataloged as well as documents from the period. The spelling and grammar have not been altered from the original writings. This was written by Lois Higgins. The newcomers. In June 1909, my parents, Mr. and Mrs. Elgood, my four sisters, two brothers, and I climbed aboard the CPR train at Quebec bound for Salmon Arm, British Columbia. We had the carriage all to ourselves except for two gentlemen, one a doctor. In one corner, there was a cooking stove slash heater. Having known nothing of the method of travel, Mother had brought along a large hamper of food and plenty of bedding, which was fortunate, for the bunks were of wooden slats. Then the elderly conductor told Dad we were on the wrong train. that we should have booked tourist, not colonist. So when we arrived at Sikkimoose on the shore of the Shuswap Lake, they put us, baggage and all, off the train. At the hotel, Mother asked for boiled eggs, toast and tea all round, but when the food arrived with the eggs broken into the larger end of a funny-looking double egg cup, Mother and Roger turned pea-green once more as they had done on the train. None of us dared look at what we considered a horrible-looking mess. However, we ate the toast in time to board the through train, which took us a few miles around the lake to Salmon Arm. There we walked across the track to the old Coronation Hotel to await our two older brothers, Evelyn and Guy, who had been in Canada for 2 years before we arrived. They soon turned up with the farm wagon and a weary horse, which walked the 10 miles up a beautiful valley with Mount Ida towering several thousand feet towards the sky on our left and high hills on the right side, all thickly forested. For the first time, we saw deer close to the road and some creatures called groundhogs with golden brown fur, which sat up about a foot high with their arms crossed over their chests and whistling indignantly at us. At last, we arrived at a cedar log house of about 24 by 16 feet, with one room down and one above connected by a ladder-like stairway. The ceiling of the bottom and the floor of the top were one, and built of 10-inch wide boards with half an inch or more between them, so that when one swept the upper, the dust sifted down to the lower. The poor old woman who was then in residence did not know that her son had sold the 80-acre farm and was very upset, and of course we were too. But she took it like a Spartan and very kindly left us the iron heater, which burned 2-foot logs and had a tin stove pipe through the ceiling and roof. She lent us the stove until we could get ours the next day. On their way up the valley, the boys had spread the news of their family's arrival, and very soon neighbors came with a lamp, matches, stable lantern, bread, butter, cheese, tea, and milk. So by nightfall, we were fed, washed, and off to bed. Mother and girls went up. Dad and the boys stayed down. Next day, a horse, a cow, 2 pigs, and some hens arrived for sale. In addition, several of the neighboring bachelors who had heard that 5 girls had arrived and every darn one of them was carrying a violin came in. The wife of our next neighbor came to show Mother how to make bread and butter and how to manage the infernal machine she called a washer-wringer. Oh, dear. Dad had already taught any one of us who were that way inclined the use of all kinds of tools and how to care for, to safely carry, and how to use a .22 rifle. The museum was very saddened to hear of local pioneer Bill Huckel's passing away. He was a wonderful source of stories and information about the neighborhood around the Haney Heritage Park. Bill used to work for R.J. Haney and his son and knew the property well. When the museum was putting in a new foundation under the Haney House, part of the old chimney was exposed. We were delighted to find a variety of signatures written on the brick with either pencil or a sharp object, and the clearest one was put on there by a young worker doing an unknown chore one day. It said, Bill Huckel, 1938. Buckle Memoirs. We arrived in Salmon Arm, British Columbia, from Romsey, England, my parents and I, in the spring of 1913. My father, Dr. Edward Buckle, was looking for a sunnier climate, which would be a welcome change to him after years of continual bouts of flu. My brother Ronald had bought a piece of land for them in Salmon Arm, which was suitable for fruit growing. From the veranda of the Montebello Hotel, we enjoyed watching the buggies and Democrats passing by in the deep mud. We noticed that all the drivers wore Stetson hats. We then journeyed up to South Canoe, sitting among the luggage, which we were able to bring with us. The 4 miles seemed endless, and the rough road caused the Democrat to jolt and jerk about so that I thought sometimes we would be turned over. In Salmon Arm, the small house in the center of our newly acquired apple orchard had been empty for many months. We sat on apple boxes for meals and slept on borrowed mattresses on the floor. Sometimes a small mouse would sit on the end of mine and take a good look at me. After a few days, we discovered that we had other visitors too, such as bedbugs. And how did they bite? Each day, we took our bedding outside into the sun until we finally got rid of them. There was no water laid on, so we washed the sheets in the mountain creek which rushed round our garden. We used bars of sunlight soap and later made our own. We felt it our duty to iron the sheets, all over which we did with the use of sad irons. The time for starting this job was 6 a.m., before it was time to cook the oatmeal for breakfast. Having very little knowledge of cooking, we often ate porridge for supper as well as breakfast and became known among friends as Pleasant and Porgy. Bread making was a real puzzle, and it was weeks before our risen dough looked like anything but a lump of solid gray rubber. Some neighbors finally came to our aid. It was no wonder a wealthy man friend who traveled with us said, "No, sweet, thank you," when offered some of our puddings. But we enjoyed a beautiful warm summer and heard many strange birds singing in the surrounding trees, especially the veeries, which appealed to me with their descending notes. In due course, strawberry and raspberry patches were planted, and Indian families came to help pick the fruit. We would often sit on the bench against the house and chat and exchange handmade baskets for clothes. In the months of July and August, many people left their farms and went camping on Shuswap Lake. Of course, there was no need to lock doors in those days. All was left open. Our family took tents and provisions for 2 weeks and rowed across the lake to Paradise Point. As we approached the shore, we were met by clouds of mosquitoes. After a day or two, we women took to wrapping our legs up in newspapers, which helped a little. On our camping trip in the fall, we used an old empty cabin and heard strange sounds in the night, which grew louder and louder towards morning. We realized at last that we had bush rats for company, and the noise was a sound made by their tails beating on some loose boards overhead. That experience cut our trip short. My father's brother, Dr. William Buckle, FRCS, from Cheltenham, decided he would immigrate too. So, in 1914, a large house on the adjoining land was built and another fruit farm developed. In their spare time, the two brothers walked about the countryside, studying the many flowers which were not found in England. All branches of science interested them, and near Gardner Lake, they found a species of moss which was new to science and was named after them. I was married to George F.B., Johnny Jones, in 1915. He had come to the east of Canada in 1909 and later walked the streets of Vancouver looking for work. There were many signs along the way saying, "No Englishman need to apply." He came to Salmon Arm in 1913. We lived in a tiny three-roomed shack with tin chimney and small lean-to kitchen. It stood among tall timber fir, cedar, white pine, and some birch. Woodpeckers built their nests in the firs, and in the fall, squirrels raced amongst the branches, throwing down cones to be cached in hollow logs. In addition, bluebirds and hummingbirds frequented the garden, and nighthawks swooped down to catch mosquitoes. Also, pheasants, grouse, and chipmunks were tame, and loons called as they flew from one lake to another. Here, the bush was carpeted with flowers, twin bells, star flowers, and lady slippers, and in the more open spaces, painter's brush, fireweed, and goldenrod. We kept a few cows and pigs and chickens, which provided us with milk, homemade butter, home-cured hams and eggs, some of which were put away for the winter in old coal oil cans filled with water glass. We planted a small orchard, grew fields of clover hay and crops of corn and sunflowers to be put in the newly built silo. In those days, farm children were usually dressed in dyed flour sacks with the lettering bleached out, as most of us were very poor. This was written by Claire Buckle Jones. In this day of environmental consciousness, we may be a little horrified at some of the strategies our forefathers had for clearing the land. There was some hacking and hewing with the axe and saw, but the quickest way to clear our land was to set fire to it. This may have been satisfactory if the conditions were just right, but one wind change and the fire would probably get away from them. There were plenty of letters to the editor in those days of apologies from one farmer to another for burning down his neighbor's barn or unintentionally clearing a bit of his neighbor's land. This is a good story of R.J. Haney setting a fire one day to clear up an acre or two, and the fire burned clear up to the Larch Hills Ridge. There are several burned stumps at the Haney Heritage Park that testify to this calamity. For the land clearing operation, a crew of Hindus was brought in from the coast and was placed in a new chicken house that had just been built. If I remember correctly, they were with us all summer, probably 1909. They belonged to two different castes, and all food purchased jointly had to be equally divided between the two. As they were vegetarians, they bought cheese and butter by the tubful, bringing them down to the house to be weighed on our scales. Because of the smell of the cheese, Dad always took the scales outside. The odor of Limburger must have lingered indefinitely, as the chickens refused to occupy the chicken house after that fall. The Hindu men were cheerful, full of laughter and chatter. Each Sunday, they went down to the lake to bathe and to wash their clothes. Their clothes consisted solely of the ones they were wearing, and there was much hilarity as they finished up with their water fights. When Dad found out we were peeking around the trees to watch this birthday suit fun, he had them move on down the lakeshore. However, the word got out, and it was surprising how many salmon-armed people chose to take their Sunday walk out past these beaches. This was written by Ruth Wilcox Raven. Wherever one goes in the country, marks of progress and enterprise greet the eye. New houses and barns and clearing operations going on, fires burning, cleaning up the land, and freshly planted orchards are the chief indication. This was from the Observer, November 8, 1907. Clearing the land had to be done mostly by hand. They cut down the trees and they were laid in windrows with spaces between them. When the horses would be taken up with the wire winches and cables. The big stumps had to be blown out with stumping powder. There was a great deal of stumping powder on the place at one time, but all that big area had to be cleared, and it was all bush and it all had to be cleared. This was written by Ruth Wilcox Raven. Many of our settlers are now busy slashing. This is an enjoyable and profitable recreation and is made still more interesting by the numbers of mosquitoes whose strict attention to business is something admirable. In the heat of the day, the mosquito takes a layoff, but the slasher is not forgotten. Swarms of small black flies having been provided which attend to his case with the same beautiful perseverance shown by the mosquito. After a while, we shall have the yellow jacket and various other species of wasp, the bush undoubtedly a splendid place for the study of natural history. This was in the Observer, June 19, 1908.
My name is Dorothy Rolin. I'm the current president of the Salmon Arm branch of the Okanagan Historical Society. If you have stories or memories you'd like to share with this program, please call Voice of the Shuswap at 250-463-5026 or email info at voiceoftheshuswap.ca.
The Shuswap had its share of mining activity around the turn of the century, and much of Salmon Arm's exploration was on Mount Ida. Lead and silver was found in some amounts and also the following, which was commented on in the May 21, 1909 issue of The Observer. Misters Will and Gordon Dalrymple are camped on the mountain prospecting for coal. We are glad to note they have discovered this mineral, but so far not in paying quantities. May good fortune smile upon the Cougar Mine. We have sometimes wondered what we should do for wood when all the trees in Silver Creek have disappeared. We need worry no longer. By that time, the coal mine will be running full blast. Here is an amusing little anecdote gleaned from the court files of February 19, 1914, issue of the Salmon Arm Observer. Pearl Fraser was up before H. Bowden, police magistrate, for furious rioting. On Saturday during the auction sale at the Orange Hall, she rode right into the crowd, hurting a little boy, fortunately not seriously. She explained to the magistrate that the horse had got beyond her control and that she had yelled a warning. Her father stated that he has ordered her not to ride on the street anymore, so she was dismissed with a warning. The Harold family were pioneer settlers across the lake from Canoe. Dr. Harold came out to the Shuswap for his health, and it was his dream to set up a dairy farm on his homestead. He kept a herd of dairy cattle and a fine flock of chickens as well. The problem was getting the produce across the lake to Canoe. Dr. Harold purchased a rowboat from the Coal Harbor Boat Works in Vancouver in 1904. The boat was a fine example of boat building, and Art Harold remembers rowing the milk and eggs across the lake to Canoe. On a fine day, it was a lovely trip, but if the wind should arise, the trip could be a terror. Art also remembered having to replace some of the ribs in the boat. He and his brother rowed up to Marble Point north of Sicamouse, where a fine stand of Pacific yew existed. Yew wood has a fine long grain and is extremely strong. They hand-carved the ribs and installed them in the boat. The boat eventually came to the museum after Jesse Harold died. It is a fine example of early boating days on the Shuswap. The following is an excerpt from an interview with Irene Nelson, a Salmon Arm pioneer. The event probably took place prior to World War I. When we first came, we stayed overnight at the Montebello Hotel. When we got up in the morning, it was June when we came, but it was still wet because they had a lot of rain evidently, and no roads, just mud and gravel and wooden sidewalks. We just decided that we didn't like this place, and we said to my mother, "Let's go back. We want to go home." There was a group of older men sitting down from us, and they heard me say this. So they started talking amongst themselves. "Have you seen so-and-so lately?" "No, I haven't, but I saw his hat going along the road the other day." "Well, was he walking?" "No, he was riding his horse." That really floored us. I wanted to leave and go back to Vancouver. I think that was probably a story about the mud that was told a good many times, you know, but that was the first time we'd heard it.
History of Salmon Arm through the eyes of a photographer. Why do people take photographs? I believe people take photographs to capture special moments in life. We want those moments of happiness, beauty, friendship, and fun to last. It is a way to remember how things used to be and to share this experience with others. I have done some historical research on a photographer who recorded the history of Salmon Arm through an extensive collection of photographs. My main references are the websites of Wikipedia, Memory BC, and R.J. Haney Heritage Village and Museum. Rex Lingford was born in Birkenhead, England in 1881. He trained as a photographer in Bristol, England. In 1909, Rex immigrated to Canada, bringing with him a full-plate camera with a Ross Zeiss lens he purchased in a second-hand shop in London, England. When Rex arrived in Salmon Arm, he set up a professional photography shop, The Studio. However, there was a competitor in town by the name of C.E. Wooldridge. As an enterprising young man, Rex eventually managed to purchase the Wooldridge business and took on a partner, W.J. Honey. Rex operated his photography business from 1909 to 1914. If you want to see some of his work, look on the website of Haney House here in Salmon Arm and bring up the archive photos. There are many photographs attributed to Rex Lingford and his amazing photography. For example, he took photographs of homes, orchard horses, Bastion Mountain, the train and train station, the steamship SS Andover, and even the Salmon Arm Tennis Club. Also, I have seen displays of his work around town and most recently in the Prestige Inn. Rex focused mostly on landscape photography, possibly influenced by family members who were landscape artists in England. His career as a professional photographer ended due to the beginning of World War I. Rex joined the BC Horse Infantry and received several medals of bravery during his time of service. Upon returning to Salmon Arm, he felt that there was not really enough money in photography and applied to be the city clerk and collector for the city of Salmon Arm. The position paid $100 per month. Rex Lingford held this position for 32 years. In 1921, Rex married Laura Wilcox and they had two children. After the war, Rex became a Christian and was a member of the St. John's Anglican Church. Rex was also active in the community, being involved with the Salmon Arm Fish and Game Protective Association and the Salmon Arm Boat Club. In conclusion, I would say that Rex loved Salmon Arm and area. He wanted to preserve the special moments he had experienced, the beautiful apple orchards, the township, the families, and their homes, the beauty of Shuswap Lake and the surrounding areas. It is amazing to view Salmon Arm through the eyes of this prolific and amazing photographer. Rex Lingford died in 1968, but lives on through his stories in the form of photographs.
The following is an excerpt from an editorial written by George Armstrong, editor and publisher of The Observer in 1913. Mr. Hamilton Land, Okanagan Road Superintendent for the provincial government, wrote an article about roads in the province and referred to Salmon Arm, saying, "And if ever the crude road-making description in Isaiah 40 had modern amplification, it was in Salmon Arm." We were asked which of the verses in Isaiah 40 Mr. Hamilton had reference to in his article dealing with the road question and Salmon Arm monstrosities in particular. Verse 4 is as follows: "Every valley shall be exalted, and every mountain and hill shall be made low, and the crooked shall be made straight, and the rough places plain." In the early days in Salmon Arm, there was no provincial department of highways. If a road was needed to be built, the farmers of the area would petition the government for the funds to build the road, and they did the job themselves. One of the first road contracts was let out to provide a connection for the farmers in the Salmon Arm West area to the businesses and railway station in town. The road pretty much followed the present Trans-Canada Highway out to the Salmon River Bridge and continued on out the valley almost to the present site of the sheltered workshop. The cost of the road, including the bridge over the Salmon River, $500. The present-day Foothill and Glen Eden roads are also built by the pioneer farmers of the area. For more information on these and other stories, please contact the Salmon Arm Museum at Haney Heritage Park or visit us when we are open during the summer season.
It had been 39 years since my last trip up to the top of Crowfoot Mountain, when I went up on horseback during a trail ride with friends. After numerous reports about the damage from motorized recreational vehicles that is occurring to the subalpine meadows and wetlands, I was eager to see it firsthand. Thanks to the extended warm, dry weather, we drove the rough road to the summit on October 10th, 2012, and enjoyed a delightful mountain bike ride to the lookout and back. It did not take long before we saw evidence of mud bogging, as nearly every bog and wetland is covered in tracks and mud that will likely be there for many decades, if not forever. Due to the lack of provincial regulations that prohibit the use of motorized vehicles in high elevations except in the Okanagan and parts of the Shuswap where there's virtually no enforcement, the disgraceful off-road vehicle wreck-reation continues unabated in accessible alpine areas throughout the Shuswap and the province. And British Columbia remains the only jurisdiction in North America without licensing and registration for off-road vehicles. It took us only about an hour and a half to cycle on the rocky road to the old fire lookout atop Mount Mobley. The Dominion Forest Service built this lookout in 1928, and like other lookouts, there was a telephone line attached to trees and log tripods in the alpine that ran down the mountain to provide for communication. District Forest Ranger Charlie Mobley supervised the construction of the lookout, the trail, and the phone line, and then named the peak after himself. Despite all the efforts, the lookout was not in service long, as by 1930, the provincial government had taken over the Forest Service and many of the Dominion fire lookouts were shut down, including Mount Mobley. Crowfoot Mountain is far from pristine. The rich meadows have long been used for grazing, first by sheep and more recently by cattle, and most of the balsam trees burned in the 1967 Magna Bay fire. The first sheep were herded to the Crowfoot pasture in 1926 on what was likely a First Nation hunting trail that had been cleared by gold miners during the 1860s as an early route to Seymour Arm and the Big Bend. At times, over 4,000 sheep grazed in the subalpine meadow during the summers, with many of these herds coming from the Barnhart Vale ranching family, the Codagnes. Amazingly, despite many decades of grazing, the native flora species of sedges and forbs are still present, according to provincial range agrologist Harold Hetherington. However, the distribution of the species have been impacted, and in areas frequented by cattle, such as those adjacent to various springs, soil hummocking occurs due to the pounding of hooves. More natural conditions may slowly be returning, as due to market conditions, the range atop Crowfoot has been vacant for 4 and now it's 5 years. As we approached the old lookout station on our bikes, we were amused by the highway sign that indicated the need for a sharp turn to the left. And no wonder, as the lookout is perched on the edge of a high cliff, that at least one vehicle missed as we could see the wreckage below. Apparently, there was also a sledder who did not make the turn. However, he managed to survive the fall and was rescued the following day. Adjacent to the lookout, which is packed full of firewood to serve as an emergency shelter in the winter for the snowmobilers, is a solar-powered communication tower. This is one of the Forest Service's many repeater stations that help provide the radio frequencies used on the logging roads. Crowfoot Mountain is listed in the Shuswap Trail Guide. Nevertheless, it would be a grueling, uninspiring slog up the 14-kilometer-long old sheep trail now frequented by ATVs and motorbikes to the meadows. It seems the best way to experience the mountain is with mountain bikes, but only high-clearance 4x4s can make it up the road. The mountain experience is the most use during the winter season, when there is an average of 10 snowmobiles per day and up to 50 on long weekends. The Crowfoot Snowmobile Club manages an impressive hut that serves as an emergency shelter and a clubhouse during the winter season, and they put a new metal roof on the old fire lookout 10 years ago.
Senguluch and Melamstia. A long, 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 long time ago, Coyote, or Sklep, or even Senkuluch, lived with Wolf, also known as Melamstia. They hunted together, and together they killed many deer and elks. Wolf one day stopped, and he said to his brother, Coyote,
"Hey, when we kill animals, you know we should take off their skins before we eat them. The skins are not even good for us to eat. Maybe we can leave the skins wherever we kill the animal, and the people, the Kalmuk, might find them and be happy to have them. They might dress the skins and make clothes. They can make drums. They can make moccasins of them." Wolf looked at Coyote, and Coyote looked back at Wolf, and Coyote started to laugh. "Oh, ta-a, 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 ta-a. Oh, Wolf, that will not do. You know how long it will take us to skin each and every single animal that we hunt and kill? No, ta-a, that will not do. We will eat the skin with the flesh." And just like that, that was that. Till this day, all the elders and our ancestors of the Sequakmakuluk will say that this is the reason that all the wolves and coyotes, when they kill or find an animal, will always eat the skin with the flesh, leaving nothing but bones. They'll say, "Oh, only if Senghuluk or Seklep would have been more considerate and not so selfish, but allowed Wolf to have his wish, our Kalmuk would have been better off."
My name is Dorothy Rolin. I'm the current president of the Salmon Arm branch of the Okanagan Historical Society. If you have stories or memories you'd like to share with this program, please call Voice of the Shuswap at 250-463-5026 or email info@voiceofthesuswap.ca. Discovering and sharing Shuswap history.
This radio program was made possible by a Government of Canada New Horizons grant, helping celebrate Canada's 150th anniversary.